Good evening, everybody. Welcome back. In a certain way, it takes a lot of effort to be on retreat. It's a it's a break from our ordinary life, of course, and we usually come, even if there's a little anxiety, we usually come with some sense of relief, just getting away for a little bit. But it's not vacation, right? It's different. I came over a little bit early and was just sitting, and there wasn't very many people here. You were all, most of you were on your way here. And it was nostalgic, and in many ways, just being in this building and just being in the Dharma Hall. And it was different in that, you know, I try to come into this space as a student, as a practitioner, and to relate to the work we're doing from that place and from those experiences and memories. And of course, I'm at work too, and so there's things that I'm managing for that I don't have to manage for when I'm on retreat. And I think for a moment, waiting for you to arrive, I was in some other place, just sitting and just reminded of what that has offered over the years, what that has come to mean, the value of that. And it's such a simple thing, right? And yet, it is sometimes the case that there's a lot of support in an environment like this that we don't always have access to. This is a special set of circumstances. Even something about the color temperature in the room reminds me of countless nights sitting late, watching my breath, hearing people's feet shuffle across the floor. And I was reminded of how difficult so many of my retreat moments were. It's so hard. And was also reminded of perhaps how maybe some of the best moments of my life occurred in a Dharma hall sitting on the floor, surrounded by strangers, people who I'm not even supposed to talk to. And I think coming in to give a talk or to facilitate a group, you know, the you know, being really intimately connected to that is a task that sometimes certain skills are labored to bring forth, and sometimes that felt sense is just more organically available. There's a story that some of you will likely have heard that speaks to the preciousness of a human birth. And that notion extends to these kinds of contexts when we are supported by everyone who came before us, who has planted seeds of aspiration and intention by sitting in this room and doing what we're doing, by practicing. Supported by the people who gave money to build these buildings and the people who cooked our food today. I don't know about you, but for me, it's pretty easy to take that for granted sometimes. And it's quite healthy when it's not taken for granted. We're coming into some sort of stream here of intentionality. And surrounded by a lot of people, past and present, who want and wish for our own well-being because they understand that the preservation of the Dhamma has an impact on the world that we live in, on the world that we leave behind when we're not here, which will be soon for all of us. So it's said that our birth in a human form is very, very precious and very rare. And the example given of how rare is to imagine that the whole universe was covered in water and there was one ring floating in that vast ocean. And under the water, there was a blind turtle swimming. And every 100 years, the blind turtle poked his head up above the surface of the water. And that turtle, by chance, putting their head through that one ring, is about as likely as us being born into the human realm. And it's also said that it's a precious opportunity to hear the Dhamma. So being born into a human realm is precious because we have the capacity to feel and experience directly suffering and do something about it, which arguably not a lot of other beings can do. So there's this potentiality within us, within our sort of our karmic lot. And so we have to decide ourselves what we want to do with that. What do we want to do with that? Many people will never hear the Dhamma. Never. It won't cross their path. If it gets near, there won't be enough interest. And a lot of people who hear the Dhamma won't be living in the right set of circumstances to really take it in, to really drink it in. Countless people in the world, both near and far us, near and far from us, are primarily focused on acquiring or sustaining a basic modicum of safety. That's one truth of the world that we live in. And we all have to do some of that, don't we, in our own lives? And here we are in this beautiful place, surrounded by well-intended people, welcomed into this precious opportunity following innumerable practitioners that have come through here, hoping to know their own mind better, hoping to find relief from their suffering, and to cultivate a certain kind of skill, a skill that would allow us to establish a greater sense of meaning and purpose than we currently know, regardless of the degree to which we've achieved that in our own life. So this is quite profound. It is said, and of course you can make what you want of this story, that the Buddha was born. And you can picture a little naked baby. And the Buddha jumped up and stood on 2 feet and put his arms up like this and said, "I am the conqueror of the world." I can remember in this thought passed through my mind when I was also just a short while ago sitting here. I remembered walking on these grounds, and this might have been somewhere between 2005 and 2007 probably. I had been on a longer retreat up at the Forest Refuge, and I forget the particulars, but I had been practicing here in the United States for some time and was getting to know my way around this community a fair amount and was starting to think about going to Asia to practice, and that included a long, somewhat difficult consideration of joining the monastic order, and which I never did. There are particular reasons for that that were not restricted to my own life, but included decision making on behalf of other people that were that I share my life with. And staying the course here in the United States was, I wanted something different, and through some relationship, some connection, I forget, I was put in touch with a teacher that was teaching regularly in our community, in the IMS community. And I think, well, I can't get the particulars right, but they were here, either at the retreat center, the Forest Refuge, or here at BCBS, and I was at one of those centers, and a connection was made, and that person invited me to go for a walk. And I had reached out to them previously and said, you know, I'm thinking about going to either Thailand or Burma to practice. And they asked me a lot of questions. There's a host of appropriate questions that you might ask someone who has those kinds of aspirations. Sometimes the answer is just to tell that person to go get a job and, you know, kind of hunker down and, you know, buy a house or something. And so I was delighted that there was this opportunity to talk a little more, and I was put in touch with this person because they had spent a lot of time in Burma and Thailand, and they had a really good sense of the different monasteries. It was very, very hard. There's no book like, Lonely Planet Guide to Buddhist Monasteries. Like, there's no source. And so you really got to dig around. And so when I got to the meeting place, he was with a monk that he had met somewhere along the way, and they were going for their daily walk. And they just invited me to come along. And in hindsight, what this teacher was doing was providing me some contact with someone who had chosen to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so we went for a long walk. It was very ordinary. Had a nice conversation, and had some opportunity to talk about the monastery in Thailand that this teacher was from. And we got back to the forest refuge, and there was some more questioning. I kind of felt like I was being interviewed. And he said, well, I'll send you an email when I get home. And I got this packet, which he had been working on for decades, traveling through Asia. And what he would do is he would visit these different monasteries, and he would practice, and he would log his experience, not his personal experience, but he would talk like the location, who the teachers are, what months of the year are those teachers, are there translators or not? What's the food like? You know, is it all meat and sun-dried, salted fish, or if you're a vegetarian, can you survive there? Is there running water? Is there hot water? All of these things. And so it was like a little kid's birthday party or something. I had the present. I had the big gift here. And so I went page by page with a highlighter and a pen. And eventually I came across this one monastery that said, you know, there was the Sayadaw was there most of the year. There was a translator there most of the year. And it had the best likelihood of decent hygiene and pretty good food. And maybe if you were a vegetarian, you would be okay. And I said, okay, I'm going. And I can remember starting to depart in the airplane, coming into Yangon, and it was not nighttime such as to be dark enough, but it was not bright day. It was around dinner time. And I looked out the window, and I could see the whole entire country littered with golden stupas. Like hundreds or maybe thousands, the whole country. And I cried. You know, there was this sense of the whole country. These stupas are, and for a poor country, now a stupa is big and elaborate and expensive. And this is one of the most poor countries in the world. And these are shrines to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And they are places where dead teachers are put in reverence so that we can go and we can be close to them. Because they committed to something and advocated for something, right? And so there's this sense of the Dharma on a massive scale. And I had never seen that before. And even though I was fully integrated as a student into this world here in the United States, and you know, and I came to find at the monastery that, you know, like I was saying earlier, like this is a special set of conditions, and it's a little easier to practice here. And I was very fortunate to, in fact, land in a very good monastery where, unfortunately, not only due to COVID, but due to a military takeover, you know, I can't get in there and see my teacher, and he can't get out and reasonably come here. We were teaching retreat, usually June or July together here in the States, and then I would go in the winter and practice. But the conditions there are incredibly supportive. You know, surrounded by monks and nuns and lay people just like us who have taken refuge in the Dharma and whose generosity practice is like nothing I've yet to see anywhere in the world. And so you come into that and there's this sense of being really held and protected by something. Protected by the Dharma ultimately is what we find. And I think about that, you know, I don't know how long the folks in the kitchen in these different buildings have been here, but I'm 49 and I was in my 20s when they were cooking me food, and they're still here. I was across the way between our morning session and the 2 o'clock session, and having some tea, and a staff member who I haven't met came over, and he was talking with me and a resident teacher that he was there to help, one of the founders of Insight Meditation Society, and he was getting ready to leave, and he looked at the teacher and he looked at me and he said, "I'm here for you if you need anything." Just like, you know. I had this feeling like this person has taken refuge in the Dharma, right? This person has taken refuge in the Dharma. And so we're given that opportunity, and it's really quite a invitation. I don't know all of you, and I don't know if you want that invitation or if it's attractive or not. But it's built into the whole legacy, everything that came before us. We don't really need another person to invite us in. It's something we can have or not have. It's just, you know, it's a choice. Henry David Thoreau wrote, "We should go forth on the shortest walk, perchance in the spirit of adventure, never to return, prepared to send back our embalmed hearts only as relics to our desolate kingdoms." Sounds like Thoreau took refuge in the Dharma in a very real sense. So how do we take refuge in something we don't really know what it is yet? Hey, what is the Dharma? We're talking about it and we're practicing it. It's like, do you eat carrot barley soup if you don't know what it tastes like? Right. Can you eat a little bit? But not like, once you stick your spoon in there, it's like you got the carrot barley soup. So what are we taking refuge in? How do we take refuge? Do we want to take refuge? And I'm not talking about... you know, smoke and mirrors and jumping through fire and An elaborate ritual or ceremony. I remember being on the top of a mountain in Peru once in icy cold water, naked, getting beat with sticks by senior shamans and thinking, nah. I don't know. Maybe, but not definitely. But the practice can hold us, actually. And there's a kind of, despite the imperfections of it, of the path, and of our teachers, and of our institutions, and of our own mind, there's a kind of elegance and refinement that begins to take shape. There is a kind of harmony over time. We don't always have access to it. We're not elegant beings a lot of the time. We're actually pretty coarse creatures. But when, with some effort, change is quite possible. And yet this Dharma is said to be subtle and hard to see. Subtle and hard to see. So subtle. So subtle. And yet it's so simple, and it's right before our eyes. I mean, it's... Any one of you could get up and head for the door at 9 o'clock and see something about your own life or the Dharma or your mind that could change the rest of your life in the most profound ways you can't even fathom right now. And there's no reason you should believe me. And I'm comfortable putting that out there as a possibility. I got up off of, well, in Burma, we don't have cushions like this. You sit on the floor. I stood up one night after many months of sitting and a long day, a very difficult, probably one of the most difficult days of my life. I stood up off the floor, and my life has never been the same. I can never go back to the version of myself that existed before getting up off of that Dharma Hall floor. And I was just watching my breath, nothing else. It is also said that we should practice the Dharma according to the Dharma. Whatever the hell that means. There's something developmental. There's something cumulative. Bhavana in the Pali comes to mind. Bhavana is simply to cultivate. The cliche of a garden is a good. It's an appropriate cliche. When we plant seeds, particularly if we're planting seeds and not the $25 1-gallon plant you buy at the nursery, if you're actually planting a seed or a there's nothing to see. You just cover it with dirt, right? There's nothing there. And under the right conditions, you get a little, there's a little tiny bit of green, and you know, maybe that grows. And you know, so for those of you that are new to practice, you know, you probably just have a sore low back and a cranky knee, and you know, I gave a list of somewhere possible definitions for the word dukkha, and you know, you're thinking dukkha is being on a paleo diet and going to a Buddhist retreat center, eating beans all day. It's like, so there's something developmental, and unfortunately, it takes effort. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's getting harder. This is my opinion, but I think the Dharma is. The Buddha said that the Dharma would. There would be a time when the Dharma was in a state of decline. I'm going to say we're there. That's an opinion. It's not. I can't back that up. I will. I can. But I know that in my backing of it up, I'm not necessarily right. That's just an opinion. I think it's safe to say that the Dharma is at risk, at the very least. When I was in graduate school, which I talked a little bit about yesterday, and at the same time that I would have been spending a lot of time at the School of Lost Borders and then in Peru, a lot of us were interested in this idea of cultural amnesia, which was defined as a double forgetting. And the premise was that, and this was in reference to, also as I mentioned, what was being referred to as earth-based ways of knowing, various rituals and ceremonies, spiritual practices, that were very common to people who live close to the earth, often across the whole globe. There were certain common practices that were done, that were preserved. And this double forgetting or cultural amnesia said that there had been a time in our past when we forgot ways of knowing that our ancestors once knew. And that arguably was problematic. I mean, if we can have less ways of knowing or more ways of knowing, what would you want? You want more? What you want? More ways of knowing. So there was a time along the way when we lost ways of knowing, certain spiritual practices, certain insights, certain ways of knowing ourselves had been corrupted or just lost altogether. Once the last generation who knew about those teachings and practices died, they were gone. Then there came a time when we forgot that we forgot ways of knowing. And at that point, we can't reclaim them at all. There's no chance. So when we come together and practice, or we wake up in the morning and make a cup of coffee at home and we go for a quiet walk, or we read a sutta passage, or we enter into a conversation with a difficult person, maybe it's at a meeting, and we walk in thinking, I'm going to be patient and compassionate. Whatever it is, we're preserving something. We're practicing the Dharma, and I'm going to suggest we're preserving something. And I don't know about you, but the things that the Dharma advocates for, I want to preserve, and I want them to be alive in the world that I live in. And I want them to be alive in the world that the people I love and care for and who care for me live in. Larry Rosenberg writes, Larry Rosenberg was the founder of CIMC, Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, fairly close to here. The practice of Dharma is learning how to live. And this is both hard and joyful work. Practice makes extraordinary demands of us. It requires that we take nothing for granted, that we accept nothing on faith alone. If we practice with diligence and honesty, then we must question everything about ourselves. We must challenge our most basic beliefs and convictions, even those we may have about the Dharma itself. Wisdom is knowing we're ignorant in a certain way. And not the negative connotation of, I'm not talking about the ignorance that we read about when we go to the letter I section of the Webster's Dictionary. I'm referring to just the simple fact that we don't see 100% clearly 100% of the time. We just don't. And so that opens a door. When we are okay with that, and we can put our posturing down, both in private and public, and we can let ourselves be a human being having a human experience, our mind and body reveal themselves to us. And we can see ourselves for what we are and what we're not. And this is really the beginning of the path. Right? So what is this Dharma we're taking refuge in? It's the teachings, the Dharma teachings, the teachings given to us by the Buddha. Those are written in books. And it's that we have the Dharma path, we have the way, certain practices, certain teachings. So there's an engagement with ideas and practices. We've been doing that in our short time together. And there's this truth. Dharma as truth. Dharma as many of you spoke to this morning, there is difference between the illusions of our perception and the way things actually are, the way things really are. And we have a formula given to us in the suttas, the three characteristics or the three marks of existence that really get at the heart of this. And the three characteristics or the three marks of existence are anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca, impermanence or change, anatta, not self, and dukkha, distress or unsatisfactoriness. And to see a anicca, anatta, and dukkha clearly, first we see that everything is changing all the time. Everything. And so when a book or a teacher really straightens their spine and sort of lays something down as something close to fact, we don't have to agree, yet we know what we're looking for. We know what we're looking at. We've been given a koan. We've been given a test. You know, like, we have to be willing to look. Okay, well, what does that person know what they're talking about, right? And so we observe our mind and body, and we don't need, there are lots of meditation instructions. We need nothing more than the basic ones we've already been working with. And there's this question there. What is static? What is unchanging? And so in between now and Monday when we leave, if you find anything, let us know. So there are these, there are thoughts and feelings and bodily sensations and moods and sounds and things we touch and taste and memories and future thoughts and fear and jealousy and back pain and belly pain and wants and desires and more sounds and more sights and more ideas. And it's like this all the time. It's actually so, it's much, much faster than this. And as mindfulness gets stronger, usually with more sustained sitting over years and then also on longer retreats, it just, it gets so fast that I wouldn't be able to snap that quickly. And the movement of mind and body is so fast that it presents a static image. There's actually two images. There's a world outside ourselves, and there's us, to which things are happening. And so we have this dualistic separation, which has a kind of core existential anxiety built into it. Who am I? How do I do this? How do I get my needs met? And what happens if I die? Right? We are completely fragmented and unwhole because we are completely fragmented and unwhole. Because we perceive the world in dualistic terms. Right? And so here I am, this solid self named Chris, giving a talk. Tired, bunch of people looking at me who are not me. You're out there, I'm over here. There's trees out there. Clearly there's a separation. Clearly there's a difference. What I am, the Dharma says, is not quite what I think I am. And the only way I can understand that or begin to make sense of that is experientially. We will never understand this teaching conceptually. But we will try. We will try. But the mind that we will use to try is the mind that is responsible for our suffering. So what do? We meditate. That's the choice we're, that's the choice we're left with. So when we are unable or refuse or fail to see clearly and integrate this law of impermanence, we take the self for solid and we experience dukkha. And that's our shared common fate as human beings. Until conditions come together and we're fortunate enough to see through that whole fabrication. Now we understand something about the mirage of self and other. There's still looking out at the world a great dualism. That's the nature of conditioned phenomena. That's the nature of an unawakened mind. But having seen differently, even once or twice, We're looking out also with a fair degree of skepticism, because we've seen it, we've gotten a glimpse of something else. And that changes nothing and everything, because the world is just as it is. We see it differently and we relate to it differently. And then we can practice and live the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma. So subtle and hard to see. The Dharma is also referred to as a gradual training. Bummer, right? It'd be good to just get it done. And so again, there's a choice there. Like life offers a lot to us. Relationships. Work, whether you love it or hate it. Taking care of children, taking care of aging parents. Building a house, growing a business, taking care of your body, exercising, cooking food, hobbies. I have a lot of hobbies right now, so I have to learn how to reorient how much time gets formal practice, how much time gets hobbies. So we all have to do this. And so this notion of training, it can push us away, right? Or we can become interested. Well, what does that mean? Like, do I want to do that or not? And to what degree? Again, this is a very personal... I think I'm making a case for something. I think my soapbox is clear. And at the same time, I don't know what anyone's path should look like. I have no idea. I don't expect you to cry on your next flight to Burma either. Like, I have no idea. And my hope for you is that you begin to have some kind of idea. And you can make it whatever you want. 2 minutes a day before you look at your phone. Two hours a day. Two retreats next year. Maybe. So we're going to need some humility. Bumping up against our mind and heart, bumping up against the ways we're unskillful, will easily find us defended, in my experience. And so therefore, with humility, we're going to benefit by agreeing to be vulnerable, first in private and then in public or not. But with ourselves, this path requires a fair degree of self-honesty. And what I will say is that being authentic is a great conservation of energy. I'm not always able to be authentic. And having the capacity, fortunately, sometimes, I recognize it as a great relief. Right? So we can just be ourselves. We don't have to be the person we want others to think we are. It's totally exhausting. Have you noticed? Are you tired yet? Do you need more sleep or more alcohol or more TV or something? Right? Just to deal with the fact that we don't know how to deal with ourselves. Right? Just be confused. Just be unhappy. Just be passionate. Just be in love. Just get divorced. Just be whatever it is that is true or right. However flawed, whatever anyone else thinks about it, is we have to be ourself before we can be a not-self. I was only going to talk for 15 minutes. So in the time that we have together over another little bit of time tonight and another 2 days, really give yourself the opportunity to bump up against the Dharma. We have these forms, which are mirrors. Sitting meditation, walking meditation, studying the Dharma, reflection. There are monasteries in the world where you don't meditate for 10 or 15 years. You just study. Right? This stuff we're doing is not, I'm not making this up. Like, this is, people have been doing this for thousands of years. Silence. That's a practice form, which you like or don't like or are ambivalent about, but it is the form. And you can only know if it works or doesn't if you do it. Same with meditation, same with walking meditation. Counsel falls into this category. I'll talk more about counsel tomorrow. Renunciation. You know, if you've been on your phone or your tablet, or, you know, your spaceship or whatever you, however you got here, like just put all that stuff aside and just, the trees want your attention, your meditation cushion wants your attention. Counsel practice wants you to speak truthfully and just listen and give these other human beings a real voice, to an opportunity to be heard. Let someone else get their lunch before you, particularly when you're hungry. Pick up the random piece of paper on the ground and put it in the recycling bin. When you catch yourself judging yourself, remind yourself all the causes and conditions that have arrived in this moment to make your skill level not what you want it, your mind not what you want it. Remind yourself, that's causes and conditions, in a certain way, completely out of your control. As soon as you befriend yourself in this way, the contraction in the mind dissolves. A more quiet mind trails behind. And every now and again, joy even comes through. If we just stop clinging and grasping and pushing away, you're already where you want to be. You're already so close to the Dharma, you're sitting inside it. If you have energy tonight at 9 o'clock, maybe go get a cup of tea and then come back here and sit until you can't sit anymore. Do walking meditation in the dark. Don't get lost, come back. If you're inspired by some of the books in the library, you're not going to have access to those books on Monday. Maybe tonight's a reading night. If you're exhausted, go right to bed and get a big sleep, if you can. Right? So intentionality, taking refuge in the Dharma, could be as simple as washing your face and brushing your teeth and making yourself as comfortable and as horizontal as you can and going to sleep. And it could be striving diligently, walking meditation, sitting meditation, reading in the reading room. So I would encourage you to be clear about how your mind and body is and what you want from your time, both tonight, when you wake up tomorrow, during the day, Monday. Because you all know what's happening on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. But we don't know what is here in practice. We have no idea. You have a pretty good sense of Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, and like, I can tell you with a fair degree of certainty what my Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and beyond is going to look like. But what happens if renunciation is real and mindfulness is strong and kindness is in the heart and we really let go? We might find that we've taken refuge in the Dharma and we have a better understanding of what that means and what it offers us. And then we have a greater capacity to choose for ourselves how we want to do this, if we want to do this, what it looks like. Okay, let's just sit for a minute. So it's just a couple minutes past 8 o'clock, and we're together tonight until 9 o'clock. So I'd like to first, just a reminder that we are in silence and we'll stay in silence now through the end of breakfast. That's a fuzzy detail because people take a different amount of time to eat. But I think technically the schedule says breakfast is 7:30 to 8. So if we're interested in the technical details, silence is until 8 a.m. So I will be ringing a bell both in the building and out front at 8:30. And that bell directs us back into the Dharma hall for our final meditation and the dedication of merit. And so I'd like to suggest walking meditation. So Dharma talk, walking meditation, and a final period of sitting. So many of you know the more formal practice that we do on retreat, which is an option for you now. And some of you might not know what I'm talking about. So normally on retreat, we alternate between sitting and walking all day long, and there's not the kind of time for conversation that we've had thus far in this program. And so when we leave the Dharma Hall and go to walking meditation, we generally walk 8 to 10 paces at a slightly slower than normal pace. And we put our attention in our feet, noticing the lifting, moving, and placing of the foot. So I'm gonna talk out loud, but you wouldn't do that. I'm doing a demonstration. So it would be lifting, moving, placing. Lifting, moving, placing. Ten or so paces, I would maybe go as far as Kristen's meditation cushion. I would stop. I would turn around. I would do my 10 paces. So you have this short track, and you have this small container, and just walking back and forth. And when the mind wanders, you bring the attention back to the feet, making contact with the ground. It's okay if you want to go outside and do it. It's okay if you want to go for a longer walk. However, if you do that, know that the mind tends to wander more. Most people would agree. If you go for a walk, more of a casual walk, the mind tends to wander more. I'm not against that. It just, you know, sort of letting you know what might happen. So as a general rule, if we're going for a longer and slightly faster paced walk, we're usually, instead of having the attention just in the feet, we have the attention in the whole body. So just feeling the body moving through space. Okay? In case I forget later, which is possible, tonight's reading is right here. There's a one for everybody. Whether you get it now or at 9 o'clock, or I'm going to leave them here. You come back at midnight after your peanut butter and jelly sandwich and get it. That's fine too, whatever you want to do. But tonight's reading is here. If you could read that before 9 o'clock, that would be good. It's shorter than, not that last night's was long, but this is quite short. Just a little bedtime reading. Okay, so I'll ring the bell in 22-ish minutes. Question?
Yeah, could you say something about what's available for walking inside? Place?
Yeah, so we only have 23 minutes, so you'll have to factor that in. The Dharma Hall is wide open. Try not to move other people's stuff. Just pick a little track somewhere. Even with all of this stuff in here, 12 people could do walking. But you can't. You all have to go the same direction for it to work. 4 or 5 people easily. I know it feels tight, but 4 or 5 people. And then all around the building. And then any of the rooms in the farmhouse. I'll ring the bell as loud as the bell rings when I ring it. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.